Hello and welcome to episode 94 of Must See Matches. I am Kieran Lefort, and joining me as always, the man behind Must See Matches, Mark Buckley. Mark, how's it going?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Just chilling on my week off. How are you doing?
Not having a week off. Not remotely having a week off. Looking forward to a week off. But I don't know when I'm going to get to book one. This week, we are talking about Nigel McGuinness versus Brian Danielson, Ring of Honor Unified, August 12th, 2006, from the Olympia in Liverpool, England. And joining us, we've already had the CEO of WXW. Now we have the COO, Taslo Jung. Tas, how you doing?
I'm well. I'm not having a week off by any standards, but thank you for having me.
No worries. Thank you for joining us. I need to ask you, how did you first get into like watching wrestling? What was it about wrestling that first appealed to you?
Oh, I was just sitting on the couch when I was, I want to say, 11 years old, and I was zapping, and I caught Ring Warriors on Eurosports.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of want to say my first ever match was El Samurai versus Jushin Liger, and later on I saw this chubby guy in karate pants called Hashimoto, who apparently was quite good, but who I did not get as a kid. And then I just took the TV paper and saw what that was. It was called wrestling, and I looked where else it was, and I found WCW a day later and WWF a few weeks later. And then I got treated to the awesome year of 1995, where WCW brought you, I don't know, Uncensored and King of the Roads and the Dungeon of Doom and the Giant in a monster truck race falling off a building and supposedly landing in a river 100 meters away. And WWE countered right away with King Mabel and football player and WrestleMania main event and Toilet Lit Hopper. So yeah, that still stuck with it. So for some reason I fell in love with wrestling.
So you're a work rate guy, yeah?
Actually, I kind of am, which is not understandable after 95.
Yeah. For people who don't know, and people outside of Europe might not know, Ring Warriors was essentially repackaged New Japan Pro Wrestling that we got on a free-to-air channel on satellite and cable TV over here. Yeah, I remember it was crazy at the time, like kind of just getting into Japanese wrestling and being able to get like free, slightly tweaked New Japan was great.
Well, there's that weird thing that Italian football legend Alessandro Del Piero was a massive fan of Tatsumi Fujinami for some reason.
Oh, things like Fujinami and like Tiger Mask, the cartoon, aired in Italy. So when the wrestler came around, he became huge in Italy.
Mm.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. How did you end up getting involved in the wrestling business?
Oh, I was just writing for little newsletters, and at this time they were still being sent out by like traditional mail, not email.
Mm.
So they wouldn't be exactly as up to date as the very expensive hotlines in Germany. But I was writing for a couple of them, and then one of them cooperated with the tiniest German wrestling promotion. And at this time, wrestling is pretty much a clique of people wearing their favorite wrestler's t-shirts and doing something that kind of resembles pro wrestling in a boxing ring.
Mm.
And 2 days prior to the show, they were like, hey, do you want to come by and referee? And I asked, do you need any training? And they're like, nope, just come by and bring a shirt.
Can you count to three?
Yeah, I counted to three and more or less good. And at the end, somebody told me, well, next week there's another show and it's 400 kilometers. You want to come with? And we're like, yeah, of course.
And I asked Felix the same question when he was on. What is kind of your day-to-day within WXW these days?
Oh, I get up in the morning and I think Felix and I share most of the responsibilities, both between strategies and day-to-day.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a little more time to invest in WXW every day. So I handle a bit more of the duties that are boring. So I do all our taxes and accounting and logistics and all that. But yeah, I'm pretty much involved in everything in WXW, but actual wrestling training of the academy. I think that's way better if actual wrestling trainer handles that. And I'm not involved in any of the video editing,
sure.
Which Mark is way better equipped than I am. But everything else, I kind of have a say in. I either do it myself or I oversee the people doing it.
You keep it running.
Yes, so I'll try to.
So, quite famously, we've talked about this many times on this show, knowing this match was coming up. Until Tuesday, I had never seen this match before. Taz, when did you first see it?
Well, I saw it at the day off because I traveled to Liverpool to, well, watch it. Mm-hmm. All of us, we had purchased WXW a few months before, 8 months, I'd say, and we were massive Ring of Honor fans. So we wanted to go over there. And at the same time, we were setting up WXW and we were doing so on ticket sales, but we were doing well on DVDs as well as on T-shirts. So we kind of said, well, let's go over there and meet people at Ring of Honor and find a way for us to import their DVDs and shirts to Germany and resell them, which we also managed to do on that day. So we made a budgetary decision to get the cheapest possible flight. So one of those rotten Ryanair airports, either Frankfurt Hahn or Düsseldorf Weeze. And we flew into Stansted because it's, well, it's UK, so it can't be far, right? Then we went to the car and drove up there. And there's always a story about, hey, if you go to wrestling, bring your gear, right? That's the story. We pulled over at some rest stop and ran into Bobby Cruz, who I knew of but hadn't met, and Nigel McGuinness, who we all knew. And we chatted for a minute. He said, well, you're coming to the show? Yeah. You're working? No. Huh. Well, we have this rather complicated match planned, and I don't know which referees are booked, but yeah, you might be a decent option. Do you mind coming to the show a bit earlier? Yeah, very happy to, right? And then Nigel talked to Brian, and Brian talked to Gabe, and Gabe ran it by Alex. And when I arrived at the Olympia, I was in.
And you were the referee?
Yeah, and I was being a part of that match.
Mark, we've achieved our goal. We've got someone who is in the must-see yep. match we are talking about to come and talk about it with us. I'm sure I've asked you before, Mark, when did you first see this? Because I think, didn't you say before you were getting into Ring of Honor like the year after this?
I think I was getting ROH DVDs at the back end, either at the end of 2006 or early 2007 was when I started getting my ROH DVDs, which is why my collection has very little before 2006. Mm. So I would have seen this within 4 to 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then my first ever live wrestling show was the Ring of Honor show in Liverpool the year after Unified. So
right.
the one in March. And then within less than 18 months later, I was traveling to the USA and Germany for wrestling shows.
Yeah.
Which is ironic because I didn't go to Unified because I was still too young to drive yet and didn't trust myself getting on a train to Liverpool. I might...
It means we don't get another Wacky Mark Travels to the Wrestling story.
I mean, the year afterwards, I nearly missed the show because the car got clamped.
Oh, Christ.
But yeah, let's stop my weird travel stories because I have way too many of them for some weird reason.
So in place of weird travel stories, give us some stats about the two guys in this match as relates to the Must-See Matches project. Is this our last Bryan Danielson match of lots?
This is the last of four Bryan Danielson matches that we've discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Three were Ring of Honor, one was AEW. Interestingly enough, he had three matches that only just missed the cut for the podcast.
Mm.
They were one vote short. They were the last Danielson versus Morishima match from Ring of Honor Final Battle 2008. They were the first ROH main event of Loki versus Bryan Danielson versus Chris Daniels at Era of Honor Begins.
Mm-hmm.
And no, sorry, it wasn't the first show. I think it was the second. But Era of Honor Begins that freeway.
Yes.
And the Brock Lesnar Survivor Series match also just missed the cut. So he nearly had nominations for three different promotions. So Bryan had 29 nominations, which made him like probably one of the five guys with the most nominations for the list.
Yeah.
Nigel, very different. This is his only match on the podcast. He only had four other nominations, three from Ring of Honor, only one of which was not against Bryan Danielson. So he had the Marufuji match in 2006. He had... the sixth anniversary show match against Bryan Danielson. He had his last Ring of Honor match, which was against Bryan Danielson at Glory of Honor, Glory by Honor 8, which was basically, it was the show when Danielson and McGuinness had announced that they were leaving to go to WWE. Mm-hmm. And to give us an idea of how well McGuinness's WWE journey went, the last nomination was in TNA 2 months afterwards.
Right.
Against Kurt Angle when he wrestled as Desmond Wolfe.
Yes. Yes.
Where it looked like he had a lot of promise, and then sadly, a lot of his momentum was cut off because some bloke called Hulk Hogan turned up.
Yes. Yes. That was the point where they were doing like fan voting for matches they wanted on TV, and Desmond Wolfe kept getting enough fan votes to be in the match the next week, despite Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan very much not wanting him on TV. Just work the result, or don't do it. It's quite simple. Wrestling's fake. You can make it up. So, the show is named Unified for this match. It's Nigel's Pure title up against Brian's World title under Pure Rules. I'm not going to explain Pure Rules now. Bobby Cruz does it eloquently enough at the beginning of the match. Mark, have you got any kind of like history of these two up to this point? This is their third singles match, right?
Yes. And the other two have been earlier in the same year. Mm. So McGuinness had started off as the sneaky, cocky heel champion for the Pure title. He'd had a long-running feud with Colt Cabana in the lead-up to becoming champion by beating Samoa Joe. But the interesting thing was Nigel changed his style during that title run. Mm. Because he focused less on the grappling and leaned more into things like lariats, including his pendulum Les Kellett lariat, which for anyone who has seen Kyle O'Reilly in the last 5 years, he's where that move came from.
Yes.
It's probably a sign that this change was because Nigel was getting booked more in NOAH. So right. He was having more and more tours with NOAH because he was like a heavyweight type build, and he was usually Doug Williams' tag partner.
That's one of my first notes, is Nigel is in great shape. Like, he's got a proper luchador barrel chest on him. He looks like he used to be in the Natural Born Thrillers. Like, he looks really good.
Yeah. So the first match between these two, it was Danielson basically said, yeah, I'm good enough. I can beat McGuinness and take your title. So at Weekend of Champions Night 2 in Cleveland, they faced off, but it was held under Pure Rules.
Yes.
And one of the things about Pure Rules is the Pure title can change hands on a DQ or a count out, but the World title does not.
Yes.
And
That explains why Cruz gets so specific in the ring introductions, saying yes. That in this match, the World title can change hands on a DQ or count out. Right,
because McGuinness won the match because Danielson did his signature dive into the crowd,
yes.
But McGuinness made it so that he could get into the ring and Danielson could not.
Right.
So McGuinness retained his title, but he didn't win the world title because the world title doesn't change hands on countouts.
Yeah.
So 3 months later in July at Generation Now, also in Cleveland for some weird reason.
Yes.
They had a title match for Danielson's belt, and it was under normal rules.
Mm.
And Danielson won with his, at the time, unbeatable small package. So the build-up is, it's 1-1. Danielson can't beat Nigel at Nigel's game. Nigel can't beat Danielson at his game.
Yes.
The unification was supposedly only announced 3 days before this match took place.
It must have been a last-ditch attempt to fill the building.
I don't know. I think from... there's a really good article which was on the Hardway HQ blog, which is right. A really good history of the Ring of Honor Pure title and has interviews with Gabe Sapolsky in it.
Mm.
And supposedly Gabe felt that they couldn't really do any more with it. They'd kind of run to the end.
Right.
McGuinness had been a made man because of the title, and it felt like it was time.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, McGuinness would be the Ring of Honor world champion within a year of this. So they knew Nigel was like a guy they were grooming to be one of their top names.
Mm.
So I think it was more the kind of, well, what can we do with it? And it is quite a convoluted title. Now, one of the things to give credit to Nigel was 7 of his 17 successful defenses, he won via count out or
right.
DQ. So he really knew how to lean into those elements, the rules.
He was massaging the rules. Yeah, you say it was sort of like convoluted, but I think it's probably easier to understand for Europeans who are used to things like rounds and more strict rules. Mm. I think it's more convoluted for Americans who are used to wild punching and, you know, less of a technical style of match.
So speaking of convoluted rules, how did you feel getting thrown into these tasks?
I don't think they are very complicated. I like matches with a specific rule set. I love water sports kinds of matches. I really like the different rule sets in Japanese shoot style wrestling. And I'm pretty confident that I got to referee this match because I was kind of used to that. And they knew I would be on that. That wouldn't be an issue. I feel they didn't necessarily know which referees they had. Mm. And they just wanted somebody who could work within that rule set and who would, of course, be there for a couple of the key things. Like, of course, there's a one rule, there's only 3 rope breaks. And after the third rope break, you could apply, you could not break a hold by the ropes, but you couldn't use the ropes to apply a hold, right? Mm. There would be a regulated 20 count on the outside rather than the pro wrestling 1. Whenever I feel like it, I go 2. Whenever I feel like it, I go 3. Right? But actually a strict 20 count, so it needs to be loud because the ring announcer isn't counting along. And it needs to be coherent. And if for example, a referee bought into that too much and was afraid for, in this case, Nigel not to return to the ring at any of the 19 counts, that would have kind of blown the gimmick. So those were two of the requirements for a referee that they wanted. Apart from that, it's... Hey, do we know this guy? That does he follow what we tell him to do? Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, I like those rules.
You can't do the red shoes Uno.
No.
did they bring any of the US referees over, or was it all other apart from you, like staffed out with British guys?
Andy Quildam was one of the two undercard refs.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. This is babyface, and that's two separate words here. Andy Quildam, prime refereeing era. Yes, okay.
Yeah, and Andy, I saw a clip of Suva Danielson, which was probably the next day when I prepared for this, and I saw Andy was refereeing that. But yeah, it was a couple of UK referees.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So as we mentioned, Bobby Cruise reads out the rules. This must be the only time in history a crowd has cheered for the announcement that a title can change hands on DQ or count out. And they cheer louder for the word that a draw will trigger a restart.
Mm.
I must make note of Taz's fabulous moustache that he's sporting in this match.
it looks great. That's one of the nice things about the match. I still had hair and I had this mustache. Nowadays, I sport the exact haircut that Brian has in this match. Sadly, he didn't switch to mine.
There is a tense handshake, a horrible early 2000s unification graphic, and a chant of fuck him up, Nigel, before the bell. You kind of hit on it, Mark, as you were like describing the build. This feels big before they start.
Mm.
So it's Ring of Honor's first ever show in the UK. These two are 1-1, and thanks to the rules, a title change is guaranteed. And as Dave Prazak points out on commentary, it will be the first one of the year in Ring of Honor. And think that we're mid-August at this point.
So the thing about this in terms of heel face dynamics, so Nigel is technically a heel, or technically has been heelish for most of it, but Danielson has also had a quasi-heel turn as well.
Mm.
Because at the Ring of Honor versus CCW Cage of Death match,
which I've also never seen.
Rather infamously, Danielson was part of the Ring of Honor team, but he actually entered the ring mostly to actually sabotage Samoa Joe and hit his knee to weaken Joe for an upcoming title match.
Right.
So he put his title over the Ring of Honor promotion. So that's an element that probably helped the crowd being pro Nigel, but I mean, Nigel had the Union Jack on his bum and on his knee pads.
Yes. A couple of things before we get started. I'd like to break the fingers of two people. The hard cam operator, who both wouldn't stop zooming and couldn't get the fucking thing anywhere near in focus. And the editor, who kept cutting to said hard cam as it was going on one of its wacky zoom journeys and would frequently cut to whichever of the two cameras they weren't using for a split second before cutting back to the other one.
Oh, there's worse. On the second day, I think it's the same hard cam operator, and there was a scene during intermission in which Gabe learned that hard cam might not have recorded the first half of the show. That was an epic reaction.
Gabe Sapolsky, very well known for being a very calm and rational person when things yes. don't go right.
Yes. There is also a third camera at ringside, but it's never used. You never cut to that shot. And I think the guy is in a Spectrum multimedia shirt, so that would make it a Len Davies camera. And my suspicion is it's on UK frame rate, not US frame rate, which would be useless to Gabe in that era. These days, that's really easy to fix. This guy barely moves all match. So the poor bastard who paid for the front row seat sat right behind him and just had to look at this guy's back for the whole match. I was, however, pleased to see that the ringside photographers appeared to be my old friends Phil Jones and Amy Hanifan, who I have spent a lot of time with over the years. Lovely, wonderful people.
Shout out to Phil, Jamesy, Benno, and regular listener Lee for helping me work out that the show was announced before the first Danielson versus McGuinness show. So it was the 28th of March that Ring of Honor announced that they were going to be running Liverpool.
Right. So that's like 4.5 months out.
I mean, this was the era when Mark Sloan was like promoting shows 6 months before he did
them. That's true. Yes. Every month you get a new match announcement. And if Dragon Gate changed their booking, tough. The match would stay exactly the same. Yeah. So we're finally going to start talking about the match. They do locking up and jockeying, and Nigel gets Dragon into a corner but breaks clean. But when Danielson has the advantage pushing McGuinness into the ropes, he fires off a cocky slap instead. They do some nice chain stuff, ending with Nigel rolling over Brian's back into an arm drag and giving him a receipt slap. Dragon makes overtures towards Nigel's arm, but McGuinness keeps stuffing or escaping whatever he attempts until Brian forces him onto the bottom turnbuckle while being held in a front face lock. And then, because Nigel is forced to break as his grip loosens, he grabs Nigel's arm, spins out, and arm whips his shoulder into the mat. And then just stomps the hell out of it, again, trying to establish himself as the heel.
Well, what I liked with this early bit is there will often be times where you have the technical part and then the match will escalate because someone will hit a strike and then it will lead into the strike portion. What I liked with the start is you had the holds, but then someone would do a strike and then they'd kind of control themselves and go back. So it had this sense of simmering underlying tension that you were wondering, when is that finally going to bubble up? Because you could see that they were both trying to hold their temper.
Right. And you had that. But every time that the scene would have played out, of course, it was Brian initiating the first slap. But every time the scene would end, it would be Nigel on top, both with the slap as well as with the elbow, as well as with the kick. So it clearly gears the match towards, hey, Nigel is the babyface and Nigel is superior right now. So this is where Brian needs to go to the arm whip out of the corner and then has this wonderful facial expression afterwards.
Yes. We have this basic little story early on of Brian commanding Nigel's arm and trying to get him to grab the ropes, but McGuinness fights his instincts to use them for the break. Eventually, Danielson uses a sit-out butterfly suplex, which sparked a memory for me. I think this is James Tye's old TIE fighter move, which I'm pretty sure I named during an FWA commentary session. he does that really slickly into a Juju Gatame to force Nigel to finally grab the ropes and burn his first rope break.
One thing that I noticed was at one point Danielson had Nigel's hand or wrist and just did not let go for about 80 seconds. So he was working the arm, control, literally having contact with the arm or the hand for a whole 80 second portion, which is a nice little touch. Kind of shows how good he was at the technical side of things.
Tess, I don't know if you remember, but since he told you directly, how many does Brian have until?
Well, I kind of sort of recall that he would yell in your face that he very much had until 5.
He does indeed. Yeah. Nigel gets the advantage back in the corner and does his bend them back spine kick falling lariat spot that I really like. It's a great little combo. He hammers in some European uppercuts, including a corner to corner one, and grounds Brian with a cobra clutch, trying to bait him into eating up a rope break. Mm. He spins that out into a kind of proto rainmaker.
Yep.
But Dragon ducks under it, clocks Nigel with an enziguri, followed by denying Liverpool a surfboard and just stomping on the backs of Nigel's knees. We've seen this before. He likes doing this as a heel, doesn't he?
Yep, it's one of those spots that he loves, just to subvert what people expect.
Mm.
And sometimes he'll do the surfboard, sometimes he'll just do the stomps. Sometimes it's because he's being a prick, sometimes it's because he can't get control of the arms.
Yes. He hits a superplex and a diving headbutt for a two count, and then immediately goes into the cattle mutilation. But Nigel uses his second rope break to escape, and Brian gleefully uses the announcement that this is rope break number 2 for Nigel to flick the crowd the V's, and then pulls this brilliant cartoonishly mean face. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Danielson was infamous because he did a few All-Star tours in the years before this, and I think he once said that if he could have afforded it, he would have just loved doing that kind of all-star camp show heel work. It's quite telling that I think the first few times he did WXW, he played into that heel stuff as well, from what I remember.
Oh, absolutely. It changed him. Like, Brian was always good, right? When you recall the first ROH matches, the freeway dance that you talked about, the round robin challenge, Brian was always really good, but he was a bit on the boring side because he was just this very good wrestler. And when he did his first, I want to say, 6 months of All-Star, he returned being this over-the-top heel character on top of this, and this really shifted things the next year. He did the same thing, I think, in Germany. He got people to yell at him that he was only doing same old shit and boring and worst wrestler in the world because he would do nothing but over-the-top arm breakers for 10 minutes.
Did he also bring the mask and the cape and be like American Dragon? Because I've seen him do that on All-Star, and he also did that on two or three FWA shows in 2003.
No, for WXW it was always the unmasked character, but I know that he did it at All-Star.
So mask or no mask, he heads up top again. McGuinness cuts him off though with a throat thrust and hits the Tower of London, his running draping cutter, out of the corner, and Brian uses his first rope break to break the pin. McGuinness puts on his own cattle mutilation, forcing Brian to use his second rope break straight away, putting them level. And as we've mentioned before, Brian, number one rule of being put in your own move, sell it like crazy.
What I like as a touch is I think they mention it on commentary that Nigel had actually used this as a finish in a match against Delirious at the previous show, or if not the previous show, one from earlier in the month.
Sure. So they're kind of trying to wind each other up a bit by using each other's stuff.
Mm. And this scene is great. Because the rope breaks mean something, it kind of feels like your club is trailing by 2, and then 60 minutes in, they do the 1-2, 64, 1 minute in, they do the 2-2, and the energy is there. But Nigel is too beaten to celebrate the way Brian did. Mm. But still, it feels like, oh, now this match is on even terms again.
I didn't write it down, but I did think at one point during one of my viewings that, yes, there was the use of the rope breaks and the evening up of the rope breaks felt very football-y. Yes, I think you're right. They head outside, and I notice, as with all the prior Ring of Honor matches we've covered, the crowd is very much prime wrestling demographic. Male, 18 to 35, and extremely white. Brian throws Nigel onto and under the timekeeper's table, and while there are a bunch of fans flipping him the bird right in his face, I enjoyed the one guy just disappointedly shaking his head at him. Brian has tipped over the table, and he uses the edge of it to choke Nigel and to pin him down, trying to win by count out. But McGuinness just about beats the count, keeping his hopes alive. McGuinness wins a forearm battle by using a lariat and getting a near fall, and then goes for his corner headstand off a whip reversal, but gets drop kicked right in the face while upside down.
Yeah.
And dropped with a rolling elbow for a two count. When Nigel kicks out, Danielson instantly grabs him in the crossface chicken wing, which we're told this is the move that won him the world title in the first place. When Dragon has the body scissors, McGuinness's only way to stay alive is to use his final rope break, and Danielson looks very pleased with himself, and then goes and challenges a fan to come in the ring and have a fight, and then says he'll kill the entire crowd. As much as I enjoy babyface Bryan Danielson, I think I like him even more as a heel. Don't forget, this man was too small and uncharismatic. That's what WWE thought of him. It's unbelievable to think that now. Like, there is nothing he can't do. So, he goes up for another diving headbutt, but spends too much time lording it over the fans and showing off, and all his head connects with is Nigel's boot. Or boat, as it says in my notes. They trade a volley of slaps, with Bryan coming out on top after he's able to chain half a dozen together, sending Nigel into the corner. McGuinness blocks a dragon suplex and dumps Danielson on the top rope, balls first, and then sends him to the mat with a middle rope lariat. He makes the cover, and Dragon instinctively uses his final rope break to break it. Nigel heads up top and headbutts Dragon off when he comes up to join him. Dickheads throw things at the ring as Daniel charges back in with a dropkick and then heads up and chicken wings McGuinness on the top rope. So remember, Nigel has no rope breaks left. Danielson has no rope breaks left. This can't be broken for being in the ropes. Nigel manages to free his arms, drops forward into the ring and hits another Tower of London, but he's a bit slow making the cover, feeling the effects of the chicken wing, and Danielson is forced to kick out despite being right in the corner because, as we said, the ropes can't save him anymore.
I will say one of my main criticisms of this is it suffers from US Indie 2000s-ism, and by that I mean limb work at the start, which is mostly abandoned in terms of selling near the end. Now, it makes sense because Nigel's main offense is the lariat and he is the face. But in hindsight, it's probably one of the things that sticks out to me as one of my main negatives.
Yeah, I can see that. And I can still see that whenever Bryan goes for the arm work in the match, Nigel finds a way to outstrike him. In the beginning, when it doesn't have as much push on it, but even when Bryan leads with two rope breaks, Nigel comes back and always finds a way to outstrike Bryan. So I can see why he would abandon that and just leave the damage that he already put on Nigel and follow another route. I could see that. And it doesn't seem to me as arbitrary as it would be with a Dragon Gate match where there's 15 minutes of limb work and then goes to 25 minutes of near falls at the same time. It doesn't feel the exact same way. So okay. I think this argument could be made. But in the end, both points are absolutely fair, right? What I really love about this one sequence is it's a chicken wing on the ropes. So, of course, now it establishes that the ropes are in play. Mm-hmm. But it's the chicken wing that previously got a rope break, and now the rope is out of place, followed or countered by the tower, which previously got a rope break.
Yes.
And now he has to kick out, and it's pretty much the same spot that takes the match to the outside both times, right? Both times it's the Tower of London, so it's kind of like a callback on itself.
And I saw like the opening limb work not really being important later on as Bryan's initial plan failed. We've talked about this before, where like wrestlers go into a match and appear to have a singular plan. You know, if they do something to an arm earlier on, they are going to get a submission finish using the arm late at the end. And this I saw as Danielson was trying something and it didn't work. So he had to switch up and try something different. And in fact, try something very different for the finish. So they roll outside, and as a small child is imploring Nigel to put him through a table, they end up either side of a ring post. Nigel pulls Brian's shoulder first into it, but Bryan puts his foot up to stop a second, and then pulls McGuinness four times head first into it. Not a wrestling head first, a legitimate head first. Yep. Nigel takes all four with his head and comes away gushing blood. And I enjoyed the one guy in the crowd going, Jesus Christ!
Two of the fans are literally as close as possible.
Yeah.
One of them is Benno.
Right. Grapple. Of course it is.
And the other one is my mate Robin, who I've been going to shows with since 2008, to the extent where I did a free count at his wedding for to do a finger poke of doom after he got married.
Yes, this guy.
And Benno
Mark also
was
big on the work rate.
Yeah, Benno horrified. Robin equally horrified.
Yeah, yeah. So 1, 2, and 4, you can just hear the crowd. The third one, possibly because the camera is right in there, is this gross funk. And I've got to ask, Taz, what was going through your head at this point? Did they clue you into this at all?
Yes, I knew this was going to happen. And,
oh, God.
And
you so you're complicit kind of, in this crime.
You could kind of see when, even 10 minutes earlier, when Nigel was thrown headfirst into a table, he would make a habit out of really headbutting the table. But I was standing there like, good Lord, why would you do this for yourself? It feels like a Fujiwara match when Fujiwara had no other tricks anymore. But Nigel commented this later on by, oh yeah, it hurt, but it's not as bad. He'd rather take that than a crazy bump.
Jesus.
I wouldn't opt this way, but yeah, it was a nice British headbutt.
a nice British headbutt to a metal post, yes. So he then takes a baseball slide that sends him into the front row, and Daniel follows up with the trademark springboard over the barrier. You can see exactly how Brian made contact due to the big smear of blood on the small of his back as he's crawling back to the ring. McGuinness rolls back in at 19, and I put he niges up, screaming, come on, while dripping blood all over the place.
Yeah.
Danielson begs off, but Nigel just headbutts him, and they exchange a load of headbutts. Nigel gets backdropped onto the apron, but twangs the top rope into Brian's face twice. The first one quite clearly missing, even from the distant hard camera.
I think the second one probably missed from
I think it did as well. More headbutts. Nigel gets sent back into the ropes and into the Kellett Lariat, but Dragon blocks it and sends him back again. Nigel struggles to get the rebound in the ropes, and I was very glad when Danielson kicked out because A, I think that move is stupid anyway, and B, this was very messy and didn't have nearly enough sauce on it to be a finish.
No.
Nigel also leaves a gross bloody face print on the mat before calling over for the cover.
Well, put it this way, by this point, Danielson's head is covered in blood and it's not his own.
Yes.
His whole forehead is just red from those repeated headbutts. And that running butting headbutt sequence, they did it again the next year.
Oh, God.
They repeated that at the Driven match, and that sequence actually ended up busting Danielson open the hard way.
I'm slightly worried by the amount of matches we have in our top 15 that have gross skull-on-skull headbutts in them. What does that say about our demographic, about the people that nominated matches?
Yeah.
Can we go back to the Nigel up, as you call it?
Yes.
I think that's the scene that made the match, right? It's before that, Brian is on top and Nigel is struggling and he got put in the post and it looked like they were both coming back to the ring easily at 12 before he got kicked back in. Then he made it back at 19 and did a pretty struggle. And then he fired himself up and got the crowd behind him so much that this was effectively a momentum shift in the match without there being actual reason for it. Brian was clearly on top. Nigel was bloody and beaten down, and just from the way he presented himself, it was very clear that he just had the upper hand of the match. It was a piece of art that wouldn't have worked without the ridiculous amount of blood.
Yes.
And the crowd was, by this point, the crowd was so heavily behind Nigel, and just, they did a fantastic job of, the crowd was behind him at the start, but they just kept building the support and building the support. So he felt like the guy. And you could tell they knew they had something, because the original plan for Nigel's title win, I believe, was meant to be in the UK. So he was meant to win it in the autumn of 2007. But by that point, either because of the economy and the exchange rate, or because of the Alex Shane relationship broke down, or probably both, they never did that second 2007 UK tour.
Right. So Brian kicks out of this lariat and he puts the cattle mutilation on again. Nigel gets to the ropes, but of course, it's no good. He rolls them back to being seated, but Danielson still has the arms. So he rolls again, putting himself on top with Brian's back on the canvas. And as we saw in the Kenta match, Brian has to let go to prevent being pinned.
Yeah.
He only lets go just enough to get his own shoulders off the mat, though, and still has the arms when they sit up again. And he switches his grip, lays in the hammer and anvil elbows, and our very astute referee judges that Nigel is knocked out, cannot continue, and Brian Danielson is the new unified champion.
The touch that I actually really liked on this is when Tass broke it up, the actual getting the arm in the way of the hammer and arm elbows was a nice touch, kind of felt a little bit UFC refereeing.
Don't forget, UFC is on the up and up at this point. So in the Observer Awards for this year, there is no separate best wrestler and best MMA fighter. It's all grouped together in best performer. So this is we're very much in the rise of the UFC, and wrestling is starting to take more and more from that. As a wrestling fan, I still remember the days before tap out submissions, when all submissions were verbal. And then UFC and MMA started up when it was still known as NHB, no holds barred. And tap outs came into wrestling as a way for people to quit without having to say the words.
Then there was also, at times it switched to one tap is enough because it's the same MMA, but in wrestling was still the, you had to tap three times and you could tap two times and just
pretty much really?
Tap out, and people get confused with that over certain times. Going back to the hammer elbow, I don't know if it was the first time it was done, but it hasn't been as done as much as it's done in the last 15 years. And I really dislike if it's pretty much, I have you in the hole, there's four elbows and the referee stops it, right? We go through so much during wrestling match, there's so much drama and so many comebacks that happen at points where people should be pretty much down for the count. So I think it's kind of key to actually wait for, okay, there's no way at all for him to return consciousness before he waves something off in wrestling.
Yes. And Nigel himself, like, he is still, for the first 10 of the elbows, is still kind of like screaming defiantly. And then his eyes close and he goes limp. And that's when the it's called off.
I mean, it's only been in, say, the last couple of years that anyone other than Danielson has actually been able to make that spot work. Because for years, people kept trying to do it. And Danielson was the only guy that could make it work. I think Moxley's there. I think Moxley's is quite good. But it's very hard to make that move look good.
Yes.
And
yes.
Danielson knew how to do it.
It's very hard to make it look good without killing the other guys. Very hard to do it well in a pro wrestling, I'm not legitimately trying to knock this man out way. One final note about the finish. The crowd boo and chant bullshit. Send them home happy, Gabe. Well, the next night's in Broxbourne, and most of them have already got their tickets anyway. Like last week, I am going to go first. I have lots of thoughts and feelings about this match. I think the action is technically good. I think their execution, particularly of all the actual wrestling in the first 5 minutes or so, is really nice. And I like Danielson's developing plan of baiting Nigel into burning through his rope breaks, working, but coming undone because he drops his guard and can't fight his own instincts, losing all of his own as well quite quickly, and then basically having to exploit head trauma to get a win. I thought that was really good. I'm going to say I think it's overrated. Given our respondents, I suspect a very strong live bias. I reckon I'm probably on, despite not being there, I'm probably on first name terms with approximately 10% of that crowd. Like, these are all people we know and people who will have responded. I also think it was a lot of, you have to see the ring post spot, which I think you do and you don't. I've seen both men have better matches. In fact, I think possibly every Danielson singles match I've seen the last 12 months, with the exception of the AEW Okada match, is better than this. And I think Nigel's King of Europe final with Doug Williams a year later in the same building is better than this. But that might be my own life bias, because I directed that show. I think it's a 3.75 to 4-star match with one insane spot in it. And speaking of that spot, who is the more foolish, the fool or the fool who follows him? Whichever one of them came up with this is a fucking idiot, and the other one is a bigger idiot for agreeing to it. Nigel's lack of care for his own head is why he didn't get a WWE run. It's stupid wrestler brains.
So in Danielson's 2014 WWE autobiography, because I don't know how ghostwritten it was.
Keith Elliott Greenberg, it's usually him.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I don't know if it is him, but he's usually the ghostwriter on these things.
He specifically says about this match that right. The headbutt was Nigel's idea.
And is it, or is he just blaming Nigel?
Yeah, that's what I mean by that. Because,
but he's still dumb enough to go along with it.
Yeah, and then they did another headbutt spot at Driven, which the thing with the Driven headbutt spot was it happened before the Benoit incident.
Right.
But it aired on pay-per-view afterwards.
Oh, that was during the and time of the taped pay-per-views. Yes.
Long enough afterwards that people had heard about the CTE and that. So it was to the extent where Gabe Sapolsky supposedly wished that they never actually aired that match or never aired that sequence in the match.
Yeah. So I think what we're left with is a good match where the must-see part of it is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen in my life. Something I really hated and arguably the worst thing about the match. I think they could have achieved exactly the same thing with a single shot into the post and a blade. Outside of the post spot, I don't think the match is good enough or different enough to be must-see. It isn't the pinnacle of a subgenre like TLC, and it's questionable if it worked for the crowd on the night if they left the building chanting bullshit.
To give the game away of what I'm going to say in a few minutes when I have my turn,
okay.
I would recommend that you track down the match from the 6th anniversary show.
Okay. Is that before or after this?
That's after this.
Right.
So you can take this match, the Driven match, and the 6th anniversary show essentially as a trilogy.
Mm.
And I'd suggest to you just have a look at that, because I think that's probably the best these two have worked together.
Okay. I'm nearly done, I promise. I think there's going to be some dickhead who says, but you said Jeff Hardy getting speared off the belt rings was really cool. Yes, it was. However, his opponent also protected him as much as possible. There was at least a little give in the ring, and they did it in front of nearly 70,000 people live and over 1 million pay-per-view buys in the biggest company in the world. Please feel free to point out any of those things being true in this case. I think the spot is must-see if you're a sick freak, but I will never watch this match again. So, now I've stirred up some controversy and will likely be hated by the internet. Taz, what do you think about this match? And is there anything we've missed from like being there and actually being in the heat of it?
Good stuff. I think in general, in early to mid-2000s, all of us at independent wrestling had too little of a grasp of the long-term damage of what we're doing. I remember having conversations with, I'll point out Generico and Quackenbush as two of the more famous people who brought it up, but of course with Danielson and Nigel Historian as known as well, of people early in their careers saying, well, I'm struggling to find words in my native language, and that shouldn't be the case, and it wasn't the case a couple of years ago. Back then, people took a crazy amount of, yes, headbutts, but also insane elbow shots or forearms to the head in places where they shouldn't have been placed. Even our own company, if I watched WXW back from 2006, 2007, people were drilling each other to the point where we would have conversations about unnecessary roughness with them, even in the Walter area, because as much as Walter is and looks terrible at everything he does, he doesn't murder his opponent. And back then, people were just connecting bone on bone a whole lot. So I think, yes, the criticism can be made towards this specific spot, but also it's part of the time where people did a whole lot of that. And if you want to stand out with stiffness or toughness or an especially rough spot in that area, this was pretty much the way they opted to go. So it's also a thing of the time. I think the bullshit call at the end is also, it's a core wrestling crowd really wanting the babyface finish, and they chant bullshit because the finish worked so well on them. They wanted Nigel to win. Everyone in the building did. Before the match started even, but when the match progressed so much. So I think that isn't necessarily a criticism towards the match. Everything else can be talked about. I wouldn't say a singular match ever is a must-see match because there are so little musts in the world and pro wrestling isn't one of them.
Mate, we're trying to do a 104 episode podcast here. What are you doing on musts?
Good thing you didn't have me on first, right?
Your entire concept is nonsense. Cancel the show.
Sorry, please retake with another guest.
No.
But I think if we go for, hey, what is time capsule of 104 great wrestling matches that you should strive to see if you're interested in both very good wrestling as well as the history of wrestling as well as diversity of wrestling, then I think 1 hour age match from 2002 to 2007, which to me personally is the most important time of Ring of Honor, despite them being bigger and maybe better later on. But this is the time where they disrupted mainstream American wrestling the same way that ECW disrupted mainstream American wrestling and years prior to that. So one match should be in there. And if I think about that time, which I absolutely loved, where I watched every single show back then, I think three matches come to mind. And one is, which I still believe is the main event of the very first show, it's the three-way dance. One is Joe Kobashi, and one is this one. Mm-hmm. And I think the three-way from the very first show, it hasn't aged well. Because Brian and Key were nearly close to how great they would get later. And we've seen so many creative freeways with crazy spots and crazier spots since. So I think if you watch that back, that would be a disappointing match. And Joe and Kobashi obviously is great. And I like Brian and Nigel a whole lot for the whole package, especially given what the show meant and what the title runs meant. But I prefer Brian and Nigel over Joe and Kobashi just because it's two Ring of Honor guys and not one Ring of Honor guy against an outside guy.
Sure.
And it's two Ring of Honor guys in the middle of their most important storyline at this time, while Joe versus Kobashi was pretty much, I want to say, out of storyline completely, right?
Yeah, it was sort of parachuted in for a one-off, wasn't it? It was, oh, we can do this, let's do it.
So I wouldn't throw star ratings around, but I'd say from the whole package, including what the match meant, yes, it's kind of must-see, and it should probably have a trigger warning for a specific spot, because right after the most terrible spot with the headbutts, it's the greatest scene of the whole match with Nigel returning to the ring and turning the match around without physicality in a totally physical match.
Mark, how about you?
My first point is this is not must-see. My second point, this is not even my favourite Danielson versus McGuinness match. Because a few people, both on our Discord and people that I've seen otherwise mentioning, were talking about the ROH-driven match and the match at 6th anniversary show as possibly being better. So after my first watch, I watched both of those matches and I watched them all in order. As I said, you can watch those as a trilogy. And personally, the 6th anniversary show is both better and also, it's less violent. But what's really clever about it is, so that was at a time where McGuinness was getting unfairly, getting a lot of heat from the US crowd, especially the New York crowd, because he was pulling out of matches because of concussions or because of concussion risks.
Surprise.
Yeah. So there was an infamous match where Aries hit him with a tope from behind and it made Nigel essentially headbutt a metal guardrail and that gave him a concussion. And then when he didn't wrestle the next night, the crowd basically turned on him. So he turned that into a heel turn. And while you can argue about the merits of having a heel turn about someone trying to protect their own health, which has throws back to, I think, Mick Foley in ECW did something similar. But the match is really well done, and it's a great story of Danielson saying, okay, I will fight you, but in order to get this match because you're threatening to give up the belt, I'll fight you for that belt, but I won't attack your head.
Right.
And it does and it's a really nice story match. It's really good stuff, and it's nowhere near as cringy as the other two that I've mentioned. But getting back to this match, I think it's a very good match. But in hindsight, it doesn't do for me now what it did then.
Yeah.
And I think it's a mix of a few things. my wrestling tastes have changed. And also, I think Danielson got better. I think Danielson in two is probably not popular. I think Danielson in 2007 and 2008 is a lot better than Danielson in 2005, 2006. I think the problem is the bloom was off the rose and the interest levels were dropping by 2007, 2008. So a lot of people weren't watching Danielson's stuff in those years.
Mm.
But I think he was significantly better in 07 and 08, especially 08. And of course, he ended up going to WWE in 2009. I think one of the reasons I think this is nominated is because, as Tass said, a lot of people probably think Ring of Honor needs to be on the list.
Mm.
And as he said, it's like, what matches do you pick? What matches stand out? So
Just quickly, this is our highest ranked Ring of Honor match. I totally forgot to mention that we're in a new bracket. We have 11 shows left to go, and we're technically in our top 10, despite this being joint ninth. This got 17.86% of all nominations.
Mm. And the thing that we've seen on this Must See Matches podcast is so many of these matches, there is something memorable that sticks out in your memory.
Yes.
Because when you're asking people to think about all the wrestling you've seen, what do you recommend?
Yeah.
We've seen it's not the great matches that are one of a series of great match. It's a match that sticks out either for an emotional reason or for something that is different to everything else.
Yes, and I kind of had to remind myself, like when I was watching it and when I was writing my notes, that must-see doesn't necessarily mean the best match ever.
Yeah.
And I think the musts, as I said, the must-see part of this is that crazy post spot that I've never seen anybody else do ever, for good reason, before or after.
Yeah.
And a lot of our respondents are of the right age and demographic and wrestling tastes to have seen this at a formative and important time in their wrestling fandom.
Well, to give a good illustration of that, Eddie Guerrero has two matches on this podcast,
mm-hmm.
and one of them is a match against JBL because he bleeds like crazy.
Yes. Yes. And as we said, like, that's not the best match ever, but you remember it because of that visual. Yes.
I like this match, and I think it's a very good match, great match, but I think we've had better Ring of Honor matches and we've had better Danielson matches on the podcast series.
Mm.
But again, Ring of Honor, there's a lot to choose from. So in summary, yeah, it's good, but I kind of agree with Kieran on this. I do actually think the match is a bit overrated.
Well, there we go. So much controversy. This was 4¾ stars in the Wrestling Observer and is currently 9.61 on Cage Match. Dave's write-up in The Observer is quite funny and understated, clearly coming secondhand from someone actually in the building before he'd got hold of the DVD. Danielson posted McGuinness, who juiced, and Danielson kept headbutting. McGuinness's forehead swelled up massively. That does not do justice to what we saw. As I mentioned, this year in the Observer Awards, Best Wrestler and Best Fighter were combined into single Best Performer, and Danielson finished fourth behind Mystico, Edge, and Tito Ortiz. He was, however, voted Best Technical Wrestler and Most Outstanding Wrestler, with Nigel coming sixth in that second category. Nigel was third in Most Improved, and the match finished fourth in Match of the Year behind, stop me if you heard these before, the Dragon Gate Chicago Ridge Six Man, episode 37, Kenta versus Marufuji, episode 19, and Kenta versus Danielson, episode 80. Tass, is there anything else you would like to impart, particularly from the day, from the experience, or are we? Is it time to take it home?
I have two little tidbits that probably aren't too publicly known. I have the original sheet that Gabe put up backstage from that show. I took it home afterwards because I figured it would be a nice souvenir. I don't know where it is, but it clearly spells at top, "This is your WrestleMania." I thought this to be a nice little tidbit.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very unsure whether Alex Shayland has ever paid me on for this, but I also never chased him up.
I wouldn't bother trying to find him these days. Although, with inflation and interest, you're probably owed like quite a decent amount of money.
I think I'm owed way too much money, but way too much to many people in the UK. Yeah. I don't mind. Like, I've got a great story out of it.
I think I'm the only person on this recording that is not owed something by Alex Shane.
Yeah, you're probably the only one he hasn't screwed over at some point or another. Taz, thank you so much for joining us. It has been tremendous having you on to talk about this match today. Feel free, the floor is yours to tell people where you can be found on the internet if you want to be found, what you've got going on, plug anything going on with WXW, anything like that.
Good luck finding me. I have an inactive Twitter account. That's about it. If you want to get a hold of me, I have an email account. It's tassilo@hey.com. So drop me a message if you like. Apart from that, find WXW. It's what I'm most proud of. It's what we do. It's independent wrestling focused on continental European wrestlers. I think it's a different product from the people alone than most things you see. It's rather high production value. It's rather high video quality value, especially with the post-production. We have recently switched to near live with the planned move of going full live, with a bit less quality in production because it won't be as polished, but it will be a lot closer, so it will be fun to watch. 16 Carat is coming up. It might be too late to plan your trip to Germany, but we have another one next year. Tickets go on sale in March, and once they go on sale, the first couple of rows will be sold out immediately. Else, we have a fall festival if you want to travel over for 7 shows in 3 days. It'll be fun. We are at wxw-wrestling.com or on Twitter, Facebook, Insta, either at Wrestling Extreme Wrestling or at WXW Germany. Come find us, enjoy it.
As someone that's done some Carrot weekends and some Tag League weekends, they are tremendous fun. I do recommend it. And also for people that are going, yes, you can eat more than just McDonald's. You just need to walk, mate.
I was planning to go this year, but unfortunately things have conspired against me and I'm not able to, which is a shame because I was really looking forward to it and it was going to be my first. So as for this show, you can go to linktr.ee/mustseematches for all the ways to subscribe, links to the full list of nominations and a whole load more. We are at mustseematches on Twitter, Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky, and we have a Discord, bit.ly/mustseematchesdiscord. You can come and have a chat there. I am at Kieran Edits on Twitter and Mark is
at monkey_buckles.
I also have another show. Every month, Nothing and Like It chronicles the UK's Frontier Wrestling Alliance's adventures on television, eventually covering the stuff that I made. You can find everything to do with that at linktr.ee/fwapod, and episode 4 is available now. Next week, probably just the two of us, as I was initially supposed to be away on a now cancelled work trip, we will be talking one of those matches many know just by the date, June the 3rd, 1994. Mizuhara Misawa versus Toshiaki Kawada. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.